while I was outside again. The sweet sick smell of formaldehyde still painted in my nose. I threw up on the sidewalk in Washington Heights, along with the junkies and the drunks. I had seen Celeste from time to time during my junior and senior years of college. I had seen other women, too. Dating was an activity that required thoughtfulness and planning and time, and in medical school I had none of those luxuries. Going out with Celeste felt the least like dating. She asked almost nothing of me, and she gave the most in return. She was agreeable and cheerful, pretty without being distracting. When I went to Philadelphia on the train, she came with me. Maeve and I would drive her to Rydell, but Celeste never insisted that I spend time with her family. Maeve and Celeste were still affectionate with each other in those days. Maeve was happy because Columbia Medical was expensive, had top ratings, and offered me no financial aid. Celeste was happy because it was farther north than Columbia's main campus, and therefore easier for her to get to from Thomas More, where she was still an undergraduate English major. My tiny apartment was two blocks from the medical school, and Celeste would come down from the Bronx after her last class on Friday afternoon and stay with me until it was time for her to work her shift at the front desk at the dean's office Monday morning. When I was an undergraduate, we worked around my roommate schedule, but in medical school, we fell into a kind of three-day-a-week marriage, which in retrospect was probably as much marriage as we were capable of. We lived under the rules that had been established when we met on the train. I had to study and she had to let me. But we also lived in the America of 1969. The war was grinding on. Protesters filled the streets. Students still commandeered administrative offices. And we had as much guilt-free, diaphragm-protected sex as time allowed. I will forever associate the study of human anatomy, not with my cadaver, but with Celeste's young body lying naked on my bed. She let me run my hands across every muscle and bone, naming them as I went along. The parts of her I couldn't see, I felt for, and in doing so, learned how best to bind her to me. The little fun I had in those days I had with Celeste, the splurge of Szechuan noodles in white paper cartons eaten on the roof of the hospital late at night, the time she got free passes to see Midnight Cowboy from her French professor, who had meant for her to go with him, everything went so well for us, until she turned her attention to her impending graduation. She wanted to start making plans for the future. That was when she told me we'd have to get married. "I can't get married after my first year of medical school," I said, not mentioning the fact that I didn't want to get married. "Things are going to get harder, not easier. But my parents won't let us live together. And they won't pay for me to get my own place and wait here while you finish school. They can't afford something like that." "So you'll get a job, right? That's what people do after college." But as soon as I said it, I understood that I was supposed to be Celeste's job. The poetry courses and the senior thesis on Trollope were all well and good, but I was what she'd been studying. She meant to keep the tiny apartment clean and make dinner and eventually have a baby. Women had read about their liberation in books, but not many of them had seen what it looked like in action. Celeste had no idea what she was supposed to do with a life that was entirely her own. "You're breaking up with me," she said. "I'm not breaking up with you. What I wanted was what I had, 3 nights a week. And to be perfectly honest, I would have been happier with 2. I didn't understand why she had to sleep over on Sundays and then get up so early Monday morning to catch the train back to school. Celeste sat down on the bed and stared out the window in the dirty air shaft in the brick wall beyond. She was sitting with her spine rounded, her pretty blonde curls tangled over her slumped shoulders, and I wanted to tell her to sit up straight. Everything would have gone so much better for her had she been able to sit up straight. "If we aren't going forward, then you're breaking up with me." "I'm not breaking up with you," I said again. But I didn't sit down on the bed beside her, and I didn't hold her hand. Her impossibly round blue eyes were brimming over with tears. "Why won't you help me?" she asked, her voice so small I could barely hear her.
"Help her?" Maeve said. "She isn't talking about you changing a flat. She wants you to marry her."
I had taken the train home for the weekend. I needed to talk to my sister. I needed to think things through without Celeste in my bed, which, despite her continued insistence that I was breaking up with her, was still where she was sleeping Friday through Sunday. I had come home to sort out my life. Maeve said she had an emergency pack of cigarettes in the glove box, and we decided that this was a good time to relapse. The leaves and flowers of early spring were already crowding out our view of the Dutch house. Wrens patrolled the sidewalk looking for twigs. You can't marry her a year into medical school. That's insane. She has no business asking you for that. And even when you're finished with school, once you're in your residency, things are only going to get worse. You're not going to have any time until you've finished. As it stood now, medical school made my undergraduate education look like one long game of badminton. I wasn't so sure how I was supposed to hold it all together once things got worse, and things would always get worse. When I finish training, I'm not going to have any time, I said. I'll be starting a practice. I'll be working. Or I won't be starting a practice because I have no intention of being a doctor, so then I'll have to go out and find a job, and that won't be the right time. I can say that for the rest of my life, can I? This isn't the right time? Though Dr. Abel had told me it wasn't like that. He said the first year was the hardest, then the second, then the third. He said it was all about learning a new system of learning, and that the farther I went along, the more fluid I would become. I hadn't told Dr. Abel about Celeste. Maeve peeled the cellophane off the pack. Once she lit her cigarette, I could tell she hadn't really quit. She looked too natural, too relaxed. Then the question isn't about timing, she said. You deserve to get married, and the timing will always be bad. Diabetics shouldn't smoke. I was far enough along in school to know that much. In fact, that was knowledge that had nothing to do with medical school. Diabetics shouldn't do anything. Have you tested your sugar? Jesus, you're going to start asking me questions about my blood sugar? Stick to the topic. What are you going to do about Celeste? I could marry her over the summer. I had meant it to sound snappish because she'd snapped at me. But as soon as I said it, I had a surprising glimpse of the practicality. Why not? A clean apartment, good food, loads of sex, a happy Celeste, a level of adulthood I hadn't yet imagined. I repeated the words just to feel them in my mouth. It sounded worldly somehow. I could marry her over the summer. All the various scenarios I'd played out in my mind up until now involved disappointing Celeste. She'd be hurt, and I'd feel guilty, and then after it was over, I would miss the naked girl in my bed. But I'd never considered the possibility of saying yes, of simply seeing this as one inconvenient time in a long string of inconvenient times ahead. Maybe marrying now wouldn't be worse. Maybe it would be better. Maeve nodded as if this was what she'd expected me to say. Do you remember when Dad and Andrea got married? Of course, she wasn't listening to me. It's strange, but my memory always conflates their wedding and the funeral. No, I do that too. I think it has to do with the flowers. Do you think he loved her? Andrea, I said, as if we could have been talking about someone else. Not at all. Maeve nodded again and blew a long stream of smoke out the window. I think he was tired of being alone. That's what I think. I think there was this big hole in his life, and Andrea was always there telling him she was the person who could fill it up, and eventually he decided to believe her. Or he got tired of listening to her. You think he married her just to shut her up? I shrugged. He married her to end the conversation about whether or not they should get married. As soon as I said it, I understood what we were talking about. So you love Celeste, and you want to spend your life with her? She wasn't asking me a question. She was just making sure, finishing things off. I wouldn't get married in the summer. The idea slipped off as quickly and completely as it had arrived. And the feeling I was left with was everything I had imagined. Sadness, elation, loss. No, not like that. We sat with the final decision for a while. You sure? I nodded my head, lit a second cigarette. Why don't we ever talk about your love life? It would be a huge relief for me. It would be for me, too, Maeve said, but I don't have one. I looked at her square on. I don't believe you. And my sister, who could outstare an owl, turned her face away. Well, you should. After I came back from Jenkintown, Celeste decided everything was Maeve's fault. She tells you to break up with me 3 weeks before finals? Who does something like that? We were in my apartment. I had told her not to come down, that I would take the train up to her and we could talk there, but she said that was ridiculous. We're not going to talk in front of my roommate, she said. Maeve didn't tell me to break up with you. She didn't tell me anything. All she did was listen. She told you not to marry me. She did not. Who talked to their sister about these things anyway? Do you think when my brother was trying to decide whether or not to go to dental school, he came out to the Bronx so we could hash it out together? People don't do that. It isn't natural. Maybe he wouldn't talk to you. I felt a quick gust of annoyance, and I let it turn to anger, anger being infinitely preferable to guilt, and maybe that's because he knew you wouldn't listen to him, or maybe he would have talked it over with your parents because you have parents. I've got Maeve, okay? That's it. Celeste felt her advantage tipping away, and she changed her tack like a little sailboat on a windy pond. Oh, Danny. She put her hand on my arm. Just leave it alone, I said, as if I was the one who was about to be hurt. It's not going to work. It doesn't have to be anyone's fault. It's bad timing. That's all. And for that small, conciliatory sentence pulled from the air, she went to bed with me one more time. Afterwards, she said she wanted to spend the night, that she would leave first thing in the morning, but I said no. Without any more discussion, we packed up what was hers and sat together on the train back up to the Bronx, each of us with a bag in our lap. Chapter 10. I did especially well in my surgical rotation. I was as conscientious as anyone else in my class, but twice as fast, which just goes to show that basketball had served me well. Fast was how hospitals made their money, so while accuracy was very much appreciated, speed got you noticed. Just before graduation, the attending pressed me to take another 3 years for a subspecialty in thoracic surgery after my residency. I had spent the last 2 hours assisting in a right lower lobectomy, and he admired the deftness of my knots. We were sitting in a tiny room with a set of bunk beds and a desk, a place we were meant to sleep for 20 minutes between cases. I kept thinking I could still smell blood, and I got up for the second time to wash my face in the small sink in the corner while the attending droned on about my bankable talent. I wasn't in much of a mood, and as I dried myself with paper towels, I told him I might have talent, but I had no plans to use it. So what are you doing here? He was smiling, anticipating the punchline of what he was sure was the setup to my joke. I shook my head. It's the rotation. This one's not for me. There was no point in explaining. His parents had probably come from Bangladesh so that one day their son could be a surgeon in New York. His entire family had doubtlessly been crushed beneath a load of debt and didn't need to hear about the effort it took to liquidate an education trust. Listen, he said, pulling off his scrub top and throwing it in the bin. Surgeons are the kings. If you can be a king, there's no point being a jack, am I right? I could see every bone in his ribcage. I'm a jack, I said. He laughed even though I'd failed to make the joke. There are two kinds of people who come out of this place, surgeons and the ones who didn't make it as surgeons, nobody else. You're going to be a surgeon. I told him I'd think about it just to shut him up. My 20 minutes were down to 14 minutes, and I needed every one of them. I was exhausted beyond anything I could remember. I wanted to tell him I wasn't going to do a residency, or an internship for that matter. Medical school would finish, and I would crack the code on real estate and sail out of this place without so much as a backward glance. Except I didn't. I tried and failed and tried again and failed again. Buildings lingered on the market for years and then sold for a fraction of their worth. I saw buildings in foreclosure go for as little as $1,200. And even when they were burned out shells covered in graffiti, even when every pane of glass had taken a brick, I thought I was the one to save them. Not the people, mind you, the ones who might have lived in those buildings. I had no grand ideas that I was the one to save the men and women who lined the hallways of the ER waiting for a minute of my time. I wanted the buildings. But then I would have to settle up the back taxes, buy the doors, fix the windows, pay the insurance. I would have to dispatch the squatters and the rats. I didn't know how to do any of that. Despite every promise I had ever made to myself, I went into the internship program at Albert Einstein in the Bronx. Not only was there no tuition for internships, okay, Maeve said, I didn't know that. They paid me. At this point, the trust was obligated only to cover my rent and give me a small amount for expenses, which I banked. I was no longer bilking Andrea in any meaningful way, not that I ever had. I was no longer avenging my sister. I was, in fact, finishing my training in medicine. I got along with the people I worked with, impressed the faculty, helped my patients, and every day reinforced the lessons I had learned in chemistry. You don't have to like your work to be good at it. I stayed at Albert Einstein for my residency, and while I still made the rare trip to the law school at Columbia, where I stood in the back of the hall to take in a lecture on real estate law, those trips were few and far between. I followed the real estate market the way other men followed baseball. I memorized statistics and never played the game. Dr. Abel still kept an eye on me, or maybe, as he would have said, we had become friends. He invited me for coffee every 3 or 4 months and kept at me until we locked down a date. He would talk about his students. I would complain about my workload. We talked about departmental politics or when we were in the company of our better selves, science. I didn't talk to him about real estate, nor did I ask him if chemistry had been the thing he'd wanted to do with his life. It wouldn't have occurred to me. The waitress brought our coffee. I'm going to London this summer, he said. We've rented a flat in Knightsbridge 2 whole weeks. Our daughter is working there. Nell, you know Nell. I know Nell. Dr. Abel rarely mentioned his family, either in deference to my own situation or because that wasn't the nature of our relationship. But on this particular spring day, he was too happy to keep his personal life to himself. She's doing art restoration. She went over there 3 years ago for a postdoc that turned into a full-time job. I don't think she's ever coming back. There was no point in mentioning that Nell Abel and I had exchanged a champagne-soaked kiss one New Year's Eve in his apartment years before. She had come into her parents' bedroom while I was digging through a pile of black coats on the bed looking for the black coat that belonged to Celeste. The room was dark, a million miles down the hallway from the music and raucous laughter. Nell Abel. We had tipped into the pile of coats for a couple of minutes before righting ourselves. We haven't been to see her a single time since she left, her father went on. We always make her come home to us. But Alice finally secured the major gift for the health sciences building campaign. 5 years she's been chasing that money down. Alice told them she'd quit if they didn't give her the time off. Alice Abel, who had so kindly set a place for me at her table all these years, worked in the development office at the Columbia Medical School. I wondered if I had ever known any more about her job than that. I wondered if Dr. Abel had been telling me this for years. His wife's job was to raise money for a new health sciences building. I wondered if Alice had told me this herself, and I had just failed to register it. I used to run into her every now and then, walking across campus. She would ask me about my classes. Did I volley back a question in order to fulfill the tenets of polite conversation, or did I merely answer and wait for her to ask me something else? They do some kind of x-ray of the paintings now, Dr. Abel was saying, to find out if there's another painting underneath, pentimental, without all the guesswork. Where? I asked. I could sense what was coming before I could fully comprehend it. My future. This moment. The Tate, Dr. Abel said. Nell's at the Tate. I took a sip of coffee, counted to 10. Where will they build the new health sciences building? He waved his hand as if to indicate up there, north. I have no idea. You'd think that would be the first order of business, but until they get that major gift, they don't make any commitments. I imagine it has to be somewhere near the armory. Do you know about the armory? What a disaster that's going to be. I nodded my head, and when the waitress brought the check, I caught it. Dr. Abel fought me, and for the first time since I had known him, I won. I stopped by the Columbia bookstore to get some maps of the Medical Center campus in Washington Heights before heading back to the Bronx. The undergraduates I passed could have been boys of 14, shaggy-haired and barefoot on their way to the beach. I sat on the steps of the Butler Library in front of South Field and unfolded my purchases. Like Dr. Abel, it seemed to me the area near the track and field armory was inevitable, even if the medical school had yet to come to this conclusion. The armory was about to be converted into an 1,800-bed homeless shelter, which would doubtlessly lower the price on surrounding parking lots. They weren't hard to find. By the end of the week, I had two under contract with a 6-month due diligence period. After all those years of banging on a locked door, I found the door wide open. The seller was a man long convinced he had no options. He had fired his broker and wore a collared shirt and tie to our meeting, hoping to take care of things himself. He was tired enough to take the deal I offered. I told him I was a doctor, and doctors had no safe place to park. I made him laugh when I said that was why none of us had cars. He liked me enough to feel sorry to be sticking me with two parking lots that had been for sale for 3 years. He thought I was cutting my own throat when I asked for a specific performance clause in the contract. He would surrender the right to change his mind, and I would surrender the right to change mine. We were locked in this together. The seller was promised he would walk out of the deal with money in hand in 6 months. The buyer promised to find that money and claim the parking lots. In retrospect, it looked perfectly obvious, but at the time I might as well have been standing with my back to a craps table throwing dice over my shoulder. I was buying two parking lots next to a massive homeless shelter. I was betting money I didn't have on the assumption that I would own the land underneath a building that had yet to be placed. I was banking that the decision about the placement of the building would be made before I had to get a loan I'd never qualify for. 5 months later, I sold the parking lots to the College of Physicians and Surgeons, and with the considerable proceeds, I paid off the seller, got a loan from the housing fund, and put a deposit on my first building on West 116th Street. Most of the 18 units were occupied. The storefront on the ground floor was split between a laundry and a Chinese takeout, both businesses in good health. According to the comps, the building was undervalued by 12%. I was finally pursuing opportunity beyond my resources. I was not a doctor. I was, at last, myself. I would have dropped out of the residency program on the day I signed the escrow papers, but Maeve said no. You could still get a doctorate in chemistry, she said on the phone. You liked chemistry. I didn't like chemistry. I just wound up being good at it. We'd had this conversation before. Then think about business school. That would come in handy now. Or law school. You'd be unstoppable with a law degree. The answer was no. I had my career, or at least the start of one. It was as close to insurrection as I ever came. Well, she said, there's no point in quitting now. Finish what you started. Maeve agreed to keep my books and handle the tax exchange codes while I went back to Albert Einstein with less than 6 months on the clock. I didn't regret it. Those final months were the only part of my medical training I ever enjoyed, knowing that I was just about to walk out the door. I bought two brownstones in foreclosure, one for $1,900 and another for $2,300. They were disasters. They were mine. 3 weeks later, I went to Immaculate Conception back in Jenkintown to attend the funeral of Mr. Martin, my high school basketball coach. Non-small cell lung cancer at the age of 50, having never smoked a day in his life. Mr. Martin had been good to me in those storm-tossed days after my father's death, and I remembered his wife, who sat in the bleachers for all of the games and cheered the team on, a mother to us all. There was a reception afterwards in the church basement, and when I saw a girl in a black dress with her blonde hair neatly pinned, I walked over and touched her shoulder. As soon as Celeste turned around, I remembered every single thing I'd ever liked about her. There were no recriminations, no distance. I leaned down to kiss her cheek, and she squeezed my hand, the way she might have done had it always been our intention to meet there in the basement after the funeral. Celeste had been a friend of the Martin's daughter, a detail I'd either forgotten or had never known. I'd learned a lot about Celeste in the years she'd been gone. I came to see her willingness to not be a distraction as something that took effort. I didn't even know to be grateful for it until I was with other women who wanted to read me articles from the paper in the morning while I was studying, or read me their horoscope or my horoscope, or explain their feelings to me while crying over the fact that I never explained my feelings to them. Celeste, on the other hand, would sink into her giant British novel and stay there. She didn't slam the plates trying to get my attention or walk on her toes to show how thoughtful she was about not making any noise. She would peel a peach and cut it up in a dish, or make me a sandwich and leave it on the table without comment the way Sandy and Jocelyn used to do. Celeste had been so adept at making me her job that I hadn't seen her doing it. It wasn't until after she left that I realized she'd stayed those Sunday nights because Sunday was when she washed the sheets and did the rest of the laundry, made the bed, and then got back in it. She and I picked up where we'd left off, or picked up in that better place where we'd been a couple of months before the ending. She was living back at her parents' house in Rydal. She taught reading at the public grade school. She said she missed the city. Pretty soon she was taking the train on Friday nights and going home on Sunday the way I had always wanted her to. She worked on her lesson plans while I made rounds at the hospital. If her parents questioned the morality of the arrangement, they never said a word. Celeste was closing the deal, and they were going to let her do it her own way. In all the years I'd known her, going back to that first train ride in the chemistry book, I'd never told Celeste anything about my plans. She knew I didn't have parents without having been told the details of what that meant. She didn't know about Andrea or the trust, or that we had ever lived in the Dutch house. She didn't know that I had bought two parking lots and sold them to buy a building, or that I would never practice medicine. I hadn't even made a conscious decision to exclude her from this information, only that I didn't make a habit of talking about my life. The residency program was almost over, and the rest of my classmates had finished their interviews, accepted their offers, and put deposits on moving vans. Celeste, who had prided herself on not asking too many questions, was left to wonder where I was going and whether or not she would be coming with me. I could see her pressing herself down, remembering what had happened the last time she'd presented an ultimatum. I knew that the uncertainty was terrifying for her, and still, I made love to her and ate the dinners she'd prepared and put off talking to her for as long as I could, because it was easier. In the end, of course, I told her everything. There was no such thing as jumping into a lake partway. One explanation led to another, and soon we were falling back through time. My mother, my father, my sister, the house, and Andrea and the girls, and the trust. She took it all in, and as the stories of the past unfolded, she had nothing but sympathy for me. Celeste wasn't wondering why I had taken so long to tell her about my life. She took the fact that I was telling her now as proof of my love. I put my hand on her thigh, and she crossed her other leg over it, securing me to her. The only part that was incomprehensible to her was the least interesting detail in the entire saga. I wasn't going to be a doctor. "But how could you go through all that training if you aren't going to use it?" We were sitting on a bench looking out across the Hudson River. We were both wearing T-shirts in late April. "All that education, all the money." "That was the point," I said. "You didn't want to go to medical school. Fine. You got there in your own way. But you're a doctor now. You have to at least give it a try." I shook my head. There was a tugboat not too far from us pushing an enormous barge, and I took a moment to revel in the physics. "I'm not going to be a doctor." "You haven't even done it yet. You can't quit doing something you haven't started." I was still watching the river. "That's what residency is. You're practicing medicine." "Then what are you going to do with your life?" Everything in me wanted to turn the question back on her, but I didn't. "Real estate and development. I own 3 buildings." "You're a doctor, and you're going to sell real estate." There was no place for Celeste to cast her vote in the matter of my future. "It's a little bit more than that." I could hear the peaceful condescension in my voice. She refused to grasp the simplest part of what I was saying. "It's such a waste," she said, her eyes bright with anger. "I don't know how you can live with it, really. You took someone's spot in the program. Do you ever think about that? someone who wanted to be a doctor. Trust me, whoever that person was, he didn't want to be a doctor either. I did that guy a favor. The problem wasn't mine, after all, it was hers. Celeste had her heart set on marrying a doctor. Maeve and I had been playing tennis over at the high school when she broke up the game after a single crack of lightning. I had an aluminum racket, and she said she wasn't about to watch me get electrocuted during a serve, so we got in the car and drove to the Dutch house just to check on things before dark. The summer was essentially over, and soon it would be time for me to go back for my second year at Choate. We were both miserable about it, each in our own way. "I remember the very first time I saw this house," Maeve said, straight out of nowhere. The felted sky hung over us, waiting to split apart. "You do not. You were just a baby then." She cranked down the window of the Volkswagen. "I was almost six. You remember things from when you were six. I'll tell you what, you would have remembered coming here." She was right, of course. I had remembered my life very clearly, ever since Fluffy cracked me open with a spoon. "So what happened?" "Dad borrowed some guy's car and he drove us up from Philadelphia. It must have been a Saturday, either that or he'd taken off from work." Maeve stopped and looked through the linden trees, trying to put herself back there. In the summer, you really couldn't see anything. The leaves were so thick. "Coming up the driveway, the house was shocking. That's the only word for it. I mean, it's second nature to you. You were born here. You probably grew up thinking everyone lived in a house like this." I shook my head. "I thought everyone who went to Choate lived in a house like this." Maeve laughed. Even though she'd forced me into boarding school, she was happy whenever I maligned it. "Dad had already bought the place, and Mommy didn't know a goddamn thing about it."
"What?"
"I'm serious. He bought it for her as a surprise."
"Where did he get the money?" Even when I was in high school, that was my first question.
Maeve shook her head. "All I know is that we were living on the base, and he said we were going to go for a ride in his friend's car, pack a lunch. Everybody in." I mean, that was pretty crazy all by itself.
It's not like we'd ever borrowed someone's car before.
The family was the three of them. I was nowhere in the picture. Maeve had one tan arm stretched along the top of the seat behind my head. She'd gotten me a job at Otterson's for the summer, counting out the plastic bags of corn and taping them into boxes. On the weekends, we played tennis at the high school. We kept the rackets and a can of tennis balls in the car, and sometimes she'd show up at lunch to whisk me off for a game. Right in the middle of the workday, no one said a word to us about it, like she owned the place.
Dad was practically gleeful on the drive. He kept pulling over to the side of the road to show me the cow, show me the sheep. I asked him where they all slept at night, and he said there were barns, great big barns just on the other side of that hill, and that every cow had her own room. Mommy looked at him and they broke up laughing. The whole thing was very jolly. I thought of the countless miles my father and I had logged in together over those years. He was not a man to pull the car over and look at a cow.
Hard to picture.
Like I said, it was a long time ago.
Okay, so then you got here.
She nodded, digging through her purse. Dad pulled all the way up to the front, and the three of us got out of the car and stood there, gaping. Mommy asked him if it was a museum, and he shook his head. Then she asked him if it was a library, and I said, "It's a house."
"Did it look the same?"
"Pretty much. The yard was in rough shape. I remember the grass was really high. Dad asked Mommy what she thought about the house, and Mommy said, "It's something all right." Then he looked right at her with this huge smile, and he said, "It's your house. I bought it for you."
Seriously?
The air inside the car was heavy and hot. Even with the windows down, our legs stuck to the seats. Not one clue. What was that supposed to be? Romantic? I was a teenage boy, and the idea of buying a mansion as a surprise had all the bells and whistles of love as I imagined it. But I also knew my sister, and I knew she wasn't telling me a love story.
So?
Maeve lit her cigarette with a match. The lighter in the Volkswagen never worked.
She didn't get it. Though really, how could she? The war had just ended. We were living at the naval base in some tiny little cracker box that had two rooms. He might as well have taken her to the Taj Mahal and said, okay, now we live here, just the three of us.
Somebody could look you straight in the face and tell you that, and you aren't going to understand them.
Did you go inside?
Sure we went inside. He had the keys in his pocket.
He owned it.
He took her hand, and we went up the front stairs. When you think about it, this is really the entrance to the house. She held out her open palm to the landscape, the street, the trees, the driveway. That's what keeps people out. But then you get up to the house, and the front is glass, so right away the whole thing is laid out for you. Not only have we never seen a house like that, we've never seen the kinds of things that belong in a house like that. Poor Mommy. Maeve shook her head at the thought. She was terrified, like he was going to shove her into a room full of tigers. She kept saying, Cyril, this is someone's house. We can't go in there. This is how it had gone for the Conroys. One generation got shoved in the door, and the next generation got shoved out.
What about you?
She thought about it. I was a kid, so I was interested. I was upset for Mommy because she was so clearly petrified, but I also understood that this was our house, and we were going to live here. Five-year-olds have no comprehension of real estate. It's all about fairy tales, and in the fairy tale, you get the castle. I felt bad for Dad, if you want to know the truth. Nothing he was trying to do was going right. I might have even felt worse for him than I did for her. She filled her lungs with soft gray smoke and then sent it out into the soft gray sky. There's a staggering admission for you. Remember how hot the front hall would get in the afternoon, even when it wasn't really hot outside?
Sure.
It was like that. We started to walk around, not very far at first, because Mommy didn't want to get too far from the door. I remember the ship and the grandfather clock were just sitting in the waves because no one had wound it. I remember the marble floor and the chandelier. Dad was trying to be the tour guide. Look at this mirror. Look at the staircase. Like maybe she couldn't see the staircase. He'd bought the most beautiful house in Pennsylvania, and his wife was looking at him like he'd shot her. We wound up going through every single room. Can you imagine that? Mommy kept saying, who are these people? Why did they leave everything? We went down the back hall with all those porcelain birds on their own little shelves. Oh, my God, I love those birds so much, I wanted to stick one in my pocket. Dad said the house had been built by the Van Hubakes in the early 1920s, and all of them were dead. Then we went into the drawing room, and there they were, the giant Van Hubakes, staring at us like we were thieves. All of them are dead, I said on my father's behalf. And I bought their house from the bank, and we get to keep all their stuff. Was everything still there with the clothes hanging in the closets? I didn't even know my mother, but I was feeling sick for her when I thought about it that way. It took a while for Dad to get up the stairs. We went through all the bedrooms. Everything was there, their beds and their pillows and the towels in their bathrooms. I remember there was a silver hairbrush on the dresser in the master bedroom that had hair in it. When we got to my room, Dad said, Maeve, I thought you might like it here. What kind of kid wouldn't like that room? You remember that night we showed it to Norma and Bright?
I do, as a matter of fact.
Well, I'll tell you, that was exactly what I was like. I went straight to the window seat, and Dad pulled the drape shut. Shangri-La, I lost my mind. And then Mommy lost her mind, because she was still thinking that this whole thing was going to be resolved, and I was going to be crushed to not have my own princess suite. She said, Maeve, get out of there. That doesn't belong to you. But it did. I knew it did.
You knew it at the time? I'd never been in the position of getting my head around what I'd been given. I only understood what I'd lost.
She gave me a tired smile and ran her hand once over the back of my neck. My hair was short, shaved in the back. That's the way things were at Choate, even in the mid-60s. I understood parts of it, but no, to tell you the truth, I didn't really understand the whole thing until Norma and Bright did their reenactment of my childhood. I think that's why I felt sorry for them, because in some way I was just feeling sorry for myself.
That was the night for it. I was certainly feeling sorry for myself. Maeve let that go. For once it was her story and not mine.
After the bedroom fiasco, we went up to the third floor. Dad wanted to show us everything.
He knew the tour was getting worse, but he couldn't stop himself. The third floor just about did him in. He wore a brace on his knee back then that didn't fit right, and he had to straight leg it up the stairs. The stairs were hell for him. He was okay to do one set, but not two. He hadn't gone to the third floor when he bought the place, and when he finally got up there, it turned out part of the ceiling in the ballroom had fallen in. It looked like a bomb had gone off. Big chunks of plaster smashed all over the floor. Raccoons had eaten their way into the house, the ones with the fleas. They had ripped apart the mattress from the little bedroom to make their nest, ripped into the pillows and the spread, and there was fluff and feathers everywhere. There was this horrible feral smell, like a wild animal and the shit of that animal and the dead cousin of that animal all at the same time. She made a face at the memory. If he was looking to make a good first impression, he would not have taken us to the third floor. I was still at a point in my life when the house was the hero of every story, our lost and beloved country. There was a neat little boxwood hedge that had been trained to grow up and over the mailbox, and I wanted to get out of the car and go across the street and run my hand over it like I used to do whenever Sandy sent me out to get the mail, like it was my house even then. Please tell me you left after that. Oh, darling, no, we were just getting started. She turned her back on the house so that she was facing me. She was wearing the T-shirt I had brought her home from Choate and an old pair of shorts, and she pulled her long tan legs into the seat. Dad's leg was killing him, but he went out to the car and got the sack lunch. Then he got plates from the kitchen and filled glasses with water from the tap and set us up in the dining room while Mommy sat on one of those awful French chairs in the foyer, shaking. He put the sandwiches on the plates and called us in. To the dining room. I mean, if he'd ever even looked at her to see what was going on, he would have let us eat in the kitchen or in the car or someplace that didn't have a blue and gold ceiling. The dining room, it was intolerable in the very best of times. He led her to the table like she was blind. She kept picking up her sandwich and putting it down while Dad went on chirping about acreage and when the place was built and how the Van Hoobakes had made their money in cigarettes during the last war. She took a final drag off her cigarette and stubbed it into the ashtray in the car. Thank you, Van Hoobakes. There was a clap of thunder, and all at once the rain came, an explosion of enormous drops that swept the windshield clean. Neither of us moved to roll up our window. But you didn't sleep there. I said it as if I knew because I could not bear it to be otherwise. She shook her head. The rain made such a pounding on the roof that she had to raise her voice a little. Our backs were getting soaked. No. He took us around outside for a minute, but the grounds were a mess. The pool was full of leaves. I wanted to take off my shoes and socks and put my feet into the water anyway, but Mommy said no. I thought she was holding my hand because she was afraid I was going to run away, but she was holding on to me because, you know, she needed to hold on. Then Dad clapped his hands together and said we should probably be heading home. He had borrowed the car from the banker for the day, and he had to give it back. Can you imagine? He buys this house, but he doesn't own a car. We went back inside, and he picks up all the sandwiches and wraps them and puts them back in the bag. None of us had really eaten anything, so of course we were going to take the sandwiches home and have them for dinner. He wasn't going to waste the sandwiches. Mommy started to pick up the plates, and Dad, I remember this most of all, he touched her wrist and he said, "Leave those. The girl will get them." No. And Mommy said, "What girl?" Like on top of everything else. Now she has a slave. Fluffy. God's truth, Maeve said. Our father was a man who had never met his own wife. Chapter 11. It fell to Sandy to call and tell me Maeve was in the hospital. She had plans to get in and get out without you knowing, but that's ridiculous. They say they're probably going to have to keep her in two nights. Asking Sandy what the problem was, I could hear the doctor in my voice, that studied calm designed to soothe all fear. Tell me what's been going on. What I wanted to do was run out the door to run all the way to Penn Station.
She's got this awful-looking red streak going up her arm. I saw it on her hand, and when I asked her what it was, she told me to mind my own business, so I called Jocelyn, and Jocelyn straightened her out. She came right over and took Maeve to the doctor. She said if Maeve didn't get in the car, she was calling an ambulance. Jocelyn's always been a better bully than me. She could make your sister do things I never could. I couldn't even get Maeve to brush her hair.
What did the doctor say?
He said she had to go to the hospital right that minute. That's what he said. He didn't even let her go home to pack a bag. That's why she had to call me so I could get her things. She made me swear I wouldn't tell you, but I don't care. Does she think I'm not going to tell you she's in the hospital?
Did she say how long she's had the red streak?
Sandy sighed. She'd said she'd been wearing sleeves so she wouldn't think about it.
It was the middle of the week, so Celeste was at her parents' house in Rydal. I called her from the payphone when I got to Penn Station and told her what time my train was getting in. She picked me up in Philadelphia and drove me to the hospital, dropping me off in the circular driveway out front. Celeste was irritated with May for not pushing me to set up a practice in internal medicine, as though I would have done it if Maeve told me to. She still thought it was Maeve's fault that I'd broken up with her years before and ruined her college graduation. Celeste blamed Maeve for everything she was afraid to blame me for. For her part, Maeve had never forgiven Celeste for insisting I marry her in my first year of medical school. Maeve also believed that Celeste had contrived her appearance at Mr. Martin's funeral, knowing full well she'd run into me there. I disagreed with that. Not that it mattered. What mattered was that Celeste didn't want to see Maeve, and Maeve didn't want to see Celeste, and I just wanted to get out of the car and find my sister. "Let me know if you need a ride home," Celeste said, and she kissed me before she drove away. It was the 21st of June, the longest day of the year. 8 o'clock at night, and still the sun came slanting in through every window on that hospital's west side. The woman at the information desk had given me Maeve's room number and sent me off to do my best. The fact that I had spent the last 7 years of my life in various hospitals in New York in no way qualified me to find my sister's room in a hospital in Pennsylvania. There was no logic to the way any hospital was laid out. They grew like cancers with new wings metastasizing unexpectedly at the end of long, tunneled halls. It took me some time to find the general medical floor and then to find my sister in that undifferentiated sea. The door to her room was ajar, and I tapped twice before walking in. She had a double room, but the divider curtain was pulled back, revealing a second bed that was neatly made and waiting. A fair-haired man in a suit sat in the chair beside Maeve's bed. "Oh, Jesus," Maeve said when she saw me. "She swore to me on her sister's head that she wouldn't call you." "She lied," I said. The man in the suit stood up. It took me just a second, and then I placed him. "Danny?" Mr. Otterson held out his hand. I shook his hand and leaned over to kiss Maeve's forehead. Her face was flushed and slightly damp, her skin hot. "I'm fine," she said. "I could not be more fine." "They're giving her antibiotics." Mr. Otterson pointed to the silver pole from which an ever-collapsing bag of fluid was hung. Then he looked at Maeve. "She needs to rest." "I'm resting. What could be more restful than this?" She looked so awkward in the bed, like she was trying out for the role of the patient in a play, but underneath the blankets, she would have on her own clothes and shoes. "I should be going," Mr. Otterson said. I thought that Maeve would try to stop him, but she didn't. "I'll be back by Friday." "Monday. You think we can't even make it a week without you?" "You can't," she said, and in return, he gave her a smile of great tenderness. Mr. Otterson patted her good hand, then nodded to me and left. We had met many times over the years, and I'd worked in his factory in the summers when I was home from Choate, but I never had a sense of him as being anything other than shy. I could never understand how such a man had grown such a business. Otterson's frozen vegetables now shipped to every state east of the Mississippi. Maeve told me that with no small amount of pride. "If you'd called me first, I would have told you not to come," she said. "And if you'd called me first, I would have told you what time I'd be here." I picked up the metal chart that hung from a hook at the foot of her bed. Her blood pressure was 90 over 60. They were giving her cefazolin every 6 hours. "Are you going to tell me what happened?" If you're not going to pursue medicine professionally, then I can't see how you're allowed to pursue it personally.
I walked around the bed and picked up the hand with the IV. An angry red streak of cellulitis started at a cut on the top of her hand, then twisted up and around to the inside of her arm, then disappeared into her armpit. Someone had outlined it with a black marker so as to track the infection's progress. Her arm was hot, slightly swollen.
When did this start?
I have something to tell you if you'd put down my goddamn arm. I was going to wait until the weekend, but you're here now. I asked her again when it had started. Maybe medical school had done me some good after all. It certainly taught me how to persist with a question that no one saw the point in answering.
How did you hurt your hand?
I have no idea. I moved my fingers up to her wrist. Get away from my pulse, she said.
Did anyone explain to you how these things go?
You get blood poisoning. You become septic. Your organs shut down. Maeve worked at clothing drives, food drives, stocking the closets and pantries of the poor on weekends. She was always getting cut, some rogue staple or nail catching her skin. She was bruised by the boxes she loaded into the trunks of waiting cars.
Would you stop being so negative? I'm lying in a hospital bed, aren't I? They're pumping me full of antibiotics. I'm not exactly sure what else I'm supposed to be doing.
You're supposed to get yourself to the doctor before the infection that started in your hand gets to your heart. It looks like someone ran a paintbrush up your arm. Did you not notice? Do you want to hear my news or not? The anger I felt when she was lying there was unseemly. She had a fever. She could have been in some pain, though I was the last person she would have admitted that to. I told myself to stop it, or she'd never tell me anything. I went back to the other side of the bed and sat in the chair, still warm from Mr. Otterson. I started again.
I'm sorry you're sick.
She looked at me for a moment, trying to gauge my sincerity.
Thank you.
I folded my hands in my lap to keep from plucking at her.
Tell me your news.
I saw Fluffy, she said. I was 29 years old that day in the hospital. Maeve was 36. The last time we'd seen Fluffy, I'd been 4.
Where?
Where do you think?
You've got to be kidding me.
It really would have been better if I could have told you this in the car. I had it all planned. We saved our most important conversations for the car. But considering the circumstances, we'd have to make do with a hospital room, the green tile floor and the low acoustical ceiling, the intermittent alert over the public address system that someone was coding.
When?
Sunday. The top half of her bed was tilting slightly up. She stayed on her back but had turned her head to face me. I'd just gotten out of church, and I thought I'd swing by the Dutch house for a minute on my way home.
You live 2 blocks from the church. Don't interrupt.
Not 5 minutes later, another car pulls up behind me, and a woman gets out and crosses the street. It's Fluffy.
How in God's name do you know it was Fluffy?
I just did. She's got to be past 50 now. She's cut off all that hair. Still red, though. Or maybe she dyes it. Still Fluffy. I remember her so clearly.
So did I.
You got out of the car?
I watched her first. She was standing at the end of the driveway, and I could tell she was thinking it over, like maybe she was going to walk up and knock on the door. She grew up there, you know, just like us.
Nothing like us.
Maeve nodded into her pillow.
I crossed the street. I hadn't set foot on that side of the street since the day we left, and it made me feel a little sick, if you want to know the truth. I kept thinking Andrea was going to come running down the driveway with a frying pan.
What did you say?
Just her name.
I said, Fiona.
And she turned around.
Oh, Danny, if you could have seen the look on her face.
She knew who you were?
Maeve nodded again, her eyes feverish.
She said, I looked like Mommy did when she was young.
She said she would have known me anywhere.
A young nurse in a white cap came in, and when she saw us there, she stopped. I was leaning so far over, my chin was practically on Maeve's shoulder.
Is this a bad time? The nurse asked.
Such a bad time, Maeve said.
The nurse said something else, but we didn't pay any attention. She closed the door behind her, and Maeve started again. Fluffy said she'd just been passing through, and she wondered if we still lived in the house.
And you said, no, I just stalked the place?
I told her we had left in 63 after Dad died. I shouldn't have said it that way, but I wasn't thinking. As soon as it was out of my mouth, poor Fluffy turned red, her eyes filled up. I think she was hoping she was going to find him there. I think she'd come to see him.
So then what?
Well, she was crying. I didn't want to be standing out there on the wrong side of the street, so I asked her to come and sit in my car so we could talk.
I shook my head. You and Fluffy parking in front of the Dutch house.
In a manner of speaking, Danny, it was the most amazing thing. When she got in the car, we were as close as you and I are now, and the way I felt, I was so incredibly happy, like my heart was going to break open. She was wearing this old blue cardigan, and it was almost like I remembered it. I could have leaned over and kissed her. I've always had it in my mind that I hated Fluffy, that she had hit you and she had slept with Dad, but it turns out I don't hate her at all. It's like I'm incapable of hating anyone or anything in my life that came before Andrea. And those were the Fluffy days. She still has that pretty face, even now. I don't know if you remember her face, but it was soft, very Irish. All of her freckles are gone now, but she still has those big green eyes. I said I remembered her eyes.
I did a lot of talking at first. I told her about Dad getting married, and Dad dying, and Andrea throwing you out. And you know what she says?
What?
She says, what a cunt.
Fluffy!
Maeve laughed until her cheeks darkened and she started to cough. I tell you what, she cut right to it, she said, and I handed her a tissue. She wanted to know all about you. She was impressed that you were a doctor. She kept saying how wild you were, that she couldn't imagine you holding still long enough to read a book, much less study medicine.
She's trying to cover her tracks. I wasn't that wild.
Yes, you were. Where has she been all this time?
She used to live in Manhattan. She said she had no idea what to do that day Dad threw her out. She said she just stood there at the end of the driveway bawling, and finally Sandy walked out and told her she'd called her husband to come and get her. Sandy and her husband took her in.
Good old Sandy. She said they brainstormed for a few days and finally decided to go to Immaculate Conception and talk to the priest. Old Father Crutcher helped Fluffy find a job as a nanny with some rich people in Manhattan. The Catholic Church helps a woman who was fired for hitting a kid to get a job looking after kids. That's beautiful. Seriously, you have got to stop interrupting me. You're throwing the story off. She gets a good job as a nanny, and while the children were still young, she marries the doorman in the building where she works. She said they kept it a secret until she got pregnant so she wouldn't lose her job. She said the first baby they had was a girl, and that girl is at Rutgers now. She was on her way to see her, and she decided to swing by the old house. No one takes geography anymore. The Dutch house isn't on her way to Rutgers from the city. She lives in the Bronx now, Maeve said, ignoring me. She and her husband, they had three children in all, the girl and then two boys. It took everything in me not to point out that the Dutch house was not on the way to Rutgers from the Bronx either. Fluffy said she checked on the place every now and then, that she couldn't help it. It had been her job before we ever moved there. It had been her job to keep an eye on things after Mrs. Van Hoobake died. She said she'd been afraid to go and knock because she didn't know what Dad would say when he saw her, but that she'd always hoped she'd run into one of us there. I shook my head. Why did I miss the Van Hoobakes after all these years? She asked me if I still had diabetes, and I told her, of course. And then she got all upset all over again. I remember Fluffy as being very tough when we were children, but who knows, maybe she wasn't.
She was.
She wants to see you.
Me?
You don't live that far from her.
Why does she want to see me?
Maeve gave me a look as if to say that surely I was smart enough to get this one myself. But I had no idea.
She wants to make amends.
Tell her no amends are in order. Listen to me. This is important.
And it's not like you're busy. Maeve didn't count the work I was doing on the building as a job. In this way, she and Celeste were in agreement. I don't need to reconnect with someone I haven't seen since I was 4 years old. I'll admit, the story held a certain lurid fascination when it was about Maeve seeing Fluffy, but I had no interest in pursuing a relationship myself. Well, I gave her your number. I told her you'd meet her at the Hungarian pastry shop. That's not going to be any trouble for you. It's not a matter of trouble. I just don't want to do it. My sister yawned extravagantly and pushed her face deeper into the pillow. I'm tired now. You're not getting out of this. And when she looked up at me, her blue eyes rimmed in red, I remembered where we were and why we were there. The overwhelming need to sleep had hit her suddenly, and she closed her eyes as if she had no choice in the matter. I stayed in the chair and watched her. I wondered if I needed to be closer to home. Now that my residency was finished, I didn't have to live in New York. I owned three buildings, but knew for a fact that perfectly good real estate empires had been made outside of the city. When the doctor came in later to check on Maeve, I stood up and shook his hand. Dr. Lamb, he said. He wasn't much older than me. He might have even been my age. Dr. Conroy, I said. I'm Maeve's brother. Maeve didn't stir when he lifted her arm to run his fingers down the track that disappeared into the sleeve of her gown. At first, I thought she must be faking it. She wanted to avoid the questions. But then I realized she really was asleep. I didn't know how long Otterson had been there before me. I'd kept her up too long. She should have gotten here 2 days ago, Dr. Lamb said, looking at me. I shook my head. I was the last to know. Well, don't let her snow you, he spoke as if we were alone in the room. This is serious business. He rested her arm at her side and pulled the sheet up to cover it again. Then he made his mark on the chart and left us there.
Chapter 12. The completion of my brief medical career had filled me with an unexpected lightness. After I finished my residency, I went through a period in which I was able to see the good in everything, especially the much-maligned North End of Manhattan. For the first time in my adult life, I could waste an hour talking to a guy in the hardware store about sealant. I could make a mistake fixing something, a toilet, say, without mortal repercussions. I sanded the floors and painted the walls in one of the empty apartments in my building, and when I was finished, I moved in. By the standards of all the dorm rooms and efficiencies I'd lived in since my extravagant youth, the apartment was generous in size, sunny and noisy, and my own. Owning the place where I lived or having the bank own it in my name plugged up a hole that had been whistling in me for years. Celeste made the curtains in Rydell on her mother's Singer and brought them in on the train. She got a job at an elementary school near Columbia and started teaching reading and what they called language arts while I went to work on the other units in the building and then the brownstones. I had no reason to think she'd made peace with my decision, but she had the sense to stop asking me about it. We had stepped into the river that takes you forward. The building, the apartment, her job, our relationship, all came together with irrefutable logic. Celeste loved to tell a softened version of our story, how we had gone separate ways after she graduated from college, victims of timing and circumstance. And then how we had found each other again at a funeral of all places. It was meant to be, she would say, leaning into me. So Fluffy was not on my mind. She was not on my mind until the phone rang months after Maeve got out of the hospital. And the voice on the other end said, "Is that Danny?" And I knew, the same way Maeve had known when she saw Fluffy there on Van Hoobake Street. I knew that she had taken so long to call because she was trying to work up her courage. And I knew that we would have coffee at the Hungarian pastry shop whether I wanted to or not. Any energy I expended trying to find it would be energy lost. There was never a time that the pastry shop wasn't crowded. Fluffy had come early and waited to get a seat in the window. When she saw me coming down the sidewalk, she tapped on the glass and waved. She was standing up when I got to the table. I had wondered if I'd recognize her based on Maeve's description. I had never considered that she might recognize me based on the 4-year-old I had been.
"Could I hug you?" she asked. "Would that be all right?"
I put my arms around her because I couldn't imagine how to say no. In my memory, Fluffy was a giant who grew taller over time, when in fact, she was a small woman, soft at the edges. She was wearing slacks and the blue cardigan Maeve had mentioned, or maybe she had more than one blue cardigan. She pressed the side of her face against my sternum for just an instant, then let me go.
"Woo," she said,
and fanned her face with her hand, her green eyes damp. She sat back down at the table in front of her coffee in Danish.
"It's a lot. You were my baby, you know. I feel this way whenever I see any of the kids I took care of, but you were my very first baby.
Back then, I didn't know you weren't supposed to give your whole heart to a baby that wasn't yours.
It's suicide, but I was just a kid myself, and your mother was gone, and your sister was sick, and your father."
She skipped his descriptive clause. "I had a lot of reasons to be attached." She stopped just long enough to drink down half